I'm going to introduce Robert Shetterly, who's going to introduce Derek Jensen. Rob's a Maine painter and activist, and his paintings and prints are in collections all over the U.S. and Europe. He began to paint his portraits of Americans who tell the truth after the events of 9/11 and the subsequent response of the United States. In his words, "I began painting the series of portraits, finding great Americans who spoke the truth, and combining their images with their words as a way to channel my anger and grief. In the process, my respect and love for these people and their courage helped to transform that anger into hope and pride, and allowed me to draw strength from this community of truth tellers, finding in them the courage, honesty, tolerance, generosity, wisdom, and compassion that have made our country strong. The paintings will not be for sale. They will stay together as a group. The courage of these individuals needs to remain a part of a great tradition, a united effort in respect for the truth. These people form the well from which we must draw our future." It's a pleasure to introduce Robert Shetterly.
Thank you, Lily, and it's a great pleasure to be here. And where's Dana? Anyway, it was such a pleasure to hear him. I'd never heard him sing before. That was a real thrill. This is a treat for me to introduce Derek Jensen. I first heard about him when I started reading his essays in Hope magazine, which unfortunately no longer exists, several years ago, and then I read his books, and then it became clear to me that I needed to paint his portrait as part of the Americans Who Tell the Truth series. Excuse me for reading some of this, but I want to say it the way I meant to say it. I found his writing thrilling because it is both exhaustively researched and beautifully poetic. So comprehensive, full of economics and ethics, politics and history, psychology and philosophy, but more importantly, full of feeling. His writing explains to us, as no one else does, the mentality and emotions of the exploiters of nature and humanity, and then the mentality and emotions of the victims, whether among those victims are Indians and slaves, salmon and redwoods, honeybees and human breast milk. He shows us that what we call Western civilization, in all its power and technology, its money and violence, is really a death wish that is coming closer and closer to being fulfilled. And then he goes on to show us how all of us are complicit. I found his writing thrilling because I knew I was hearing the truth. And that until we hear the truth, the full truth, all our attempts to change are absurd. You can't fix anything if you don't come to terms with the depth of the problem. The great folk singer and storyteller of the labor movement, Utah Phillips, likes to say, "The degree to which you resist injustice is the degree to which you are free." Derek Jensen is one of the freest people I know. But that is not the message, admiring Derek for his degree of resistance. His message is that we must shuck off the complacency and the politeness of our complicity, and each of us take responsibility for protecting the earth. Not admiration, but action is the message. That until we take responsibility for our actions, we are not of nature, but against nature, and we will reap what we sow. It is a great honor to introduce to you one of the earth's great truth tellers, Derek Jensen. Thank you.
So can you hear me okay in the back? Is that all right? Move a little closer. How's that? Is that better? The reason, I think, given for the break after Dana's songs, was so people could go to the bathroom, but I think the real reason was so that I could stop crying. There's three of Dana's songs that always get to me. One of them is the one he ended with. Another is A Drop of Water. And then, oddly enough, another one is Cows with Guns. Anyway, so that whole effort of the 15 minutes off was just ruined by your introduction. I'm just up here. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. So I would like to thank all of you for coming. And I would also like to thank the Audubon Expedition Institute and Lily and Jasper, whose idea this was. Where are they? And where's Jasper? Okay. I would also like to thank Claire, whom I promised not to embarrass by asking her to stand up. And I would like to thank Rob for his extraordinary, extraordinary work. And Gary Lawless and Dana, obviously. Lear and Eric. I would like to thank Chloe and Meeting Brook, Tara Pass, Julie, W-E-R-U, Rick, Nick, and Caroline. And then also I would like to thank one of my heroes, who is Maureen Block. This, by the way, is how I know we're not going to have a revolution, because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. And I would also like to thank Nathan and Joanna and Brianna and Daniel and Jonathan. I'd also like to thank the people who are on the run and just say, fly low. I guess also before we go any further, are there any like undercover FBI agents in here? It's worth a try. So if there are, then I have a message for you. Well, fuck you, that's one part of the message. And another part of the message is that when he was on trial for his life in Jerusalem, part of Adolf Eichmann's defense was that no one had ever told him that what he was doing is wrong. And I will not allow you that defense, and I want to say publicly that what you're doing is wrong, and I plan on seeing you held accountable someday. Okay, I don't know if you know this, but the movie Star Wars was not, the first draft of the movie Star Wars was quite a bit different than the later drafts and the version that finally made the screen. The original draft was written by environmentalists and was radically, radically different. And for those, is there anybody in here who doesn't know the plot of Star Wars? Oh, that's cool. That's great. That makes me so happy that there are a few people who actually don't know the movie. That's great. The movie came out when I was in high school, which is just the perfect time to have seen it. And I saw it and I really liked it a lot. I mean, I wasn't one of those nerds who saw it 1,000 times or anything. I mean, I wasn't a nerd, and B, I was way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. Anyway, anyway, high school is a great time to see it. You know, it's like, oh my God, I was telling all my friends, the acting is so good. Anyway, the plot, for those of you who don't know it, is that, the Empire has built this thing called a Death Star, which is this huge machine that is capable of destroying entire planets. And of course, it's a wonderful metaphor for civilization, is, you know, a machine that is capable of destroying a planet. And the rebels are fighting back against the Empire, and they are able to figure out a way, they discover a way that they can actually destroy the Death Star. And so Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters, and then he's able to, like, get real close, and he drops a proton torpedo into their thermal exhaust port. Which, I'm really not a nerd. And he blows up the whole Death Star. And that's pretty much the climax of the movie. But the environmentalist version is quite... Well, first off, the environmentalist version wasn't called Star Wars. The environmentalist version was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And in this version, the rebels do not, of course, actually blow up the Death Star, but instead they use other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up a bunch of programs for people on the planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. And audience members also discover that there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. The purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that will get viewers to the edges of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire. They attempt to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader was required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they'll leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. And then scribbled in the margins, a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it's imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, and that they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, we all know that that would be enough not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine and exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed, link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. And stirring debates are then held on screen among these rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the very end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Okay, once inside the Death Star, a splinter group breaks off from those about to lock themselves down, and they rush down these hallways, and somehow they avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple of transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And then a few of the rebels actually break off from that group, and they sneak down all these hallways, and they get past all the troopers, and they finally actually make it to Darth Vader's headquarters, and they sneak up, he's all alone, and they sneak up behind him, and then they hit him with a vegan cream pie. The producers decided to cut that scene because it was too close to another movie that they were making at the same time that was called The Plot to Pie Hitler. Near the end of the movie, another debate is held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem that I had with this particular screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifists, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader. And remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. And he didn't mention whether those tears were of frustration. Finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And the rest of the rebels are horrified. They say, voices firm behind the sobs, you can't blow up the Death Star. What about the janitors? So, in the exciting final scene of this version, a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and the two robots on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase the four from the room and from the film, and they're never seen again, which really isn't very important because they're minor characters anyway. So anyway, what happens is the Death Star just looms closer and closer and closer. And then you see the planet, and, you know, the audience members are just chewing their fingernails, waiting to see whether the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. And then you see the planet, then you see the Death Star, then you see the planet, the Death Star. You see the lasers start to glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet again, and that's the environmentalists getting off before the planet explodes. And then the planet gets blown up, and then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article from the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times, which devotes a full 3 sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yeah, we got some press. I gave a talk a couple years ago in Asheville, North Carolina, and afterwards, somebody during the Q&A, this one guy said, raised his hand, and he said, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And I said, I don't know, I'll bite. How many? And he said, it wasn't a riddle. I'm like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And I, of course, didn't have an answer. And that night, I really fixated on, I went back to my hotel room and I fixated on this question, which frankly says a lot more about my social life than I wanted to. And finally an answer came to me, which is, how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. 1 to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change. 4 to circulate online petitions. 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change. 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs. 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself. 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change. And finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb, because we all know it's never going to change. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that word lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, so Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? What'll it take for you to call it an apocalypse? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so thick that people are afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so thick that horses are afraid to get in the water, so thick that you could hear them for miles before you see them? After a talk I did once, somebody came up and gave me a photograph of a river up in Alaska, And I just looked at the photograph, and I didn't see anything exciting about it at first. It was just a river with a yellow bank and a sort of grayish-brown bottom. And then you look at it more closely, and you see that that's not the bottom of the river. It's fish. The river is full of fish. And I showed the picture to my mom, and my mom said, yeah, give it another 10 or 15 years, and it'll be gone too. We need to bring this down now. Thanks, Mom. So what'll it take? Will it take the death of runs of salmon? Will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons here that were so large they darkened the sky for days at a time, flying? I'll wait. It's probably the fucking feds. So will it take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darkened the sky for days at a time? They were here, you know, flying 60 miles an hour, sounding like thunder. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews that are almost as big. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into dead zone. Maybe it'll take the death of the cod. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. 90%. The response by the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service's division charged with overseeing the murder of the oceans, his response to that was, that's not a problem. We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable. So in two sentences, he destroyed the words problem, decline, reasonable, and sustainable. I don't have his address, so I can't give it to you. So what'll it take? Will it take dioxin in every mother's breast milk? Will it take global warming? What'll it take, Derek, for you to finally call it an apocalypse? So Endgame really came about because I would ask people all over the country, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And that's pretty much the typical response is people would shake their heads no. A lot of people would laugh. One guy at one of my talks raised his hand. Everybody looked at him and said, oh, voluntary. No, of course not. And the point is that, of course, someday we will be living in a sane and sustainable way, or we won't be living at all. But the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about the place you live, or you care about life at all, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is that we don't really know. And the reason that we don't know is because we don't really talk about it. And the reason that we don't really talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And I'm going to bash hope later. That's one of my favorite things to do. And so this book really came about that if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And that's really what the book's about. And what I'd like to do for the rest of the talk is to go through the premises of the book, or I'll go through a lot of them. And what I did with this book, which is different than any other book I've ever seen, is that I laid out my premises in italics at the beginning of the book. And one of the reasons I did that is because one of the first rules of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, and I didn't want to do that. So an example of that is you hear some talking head on television say, so how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Good question. Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? And Hitler did the same thing. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So you can say, so what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? God, Adolf, good question. What are we going to do about it? Well, what he has slid by you is the notion that there is a Jewish problem you have to do something about. And that happens all the time. And so once again, I didn't want to do that. So I wanted to lay them out explicitly. So I'd like to start with the first premise here. And the first premise of the book is that civilization, industrial civilization, but all civilization, but especially industrial civilization, is not and can never be sustainable. Industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding in a car with my friend George Drappin, with whom I'd written a couple books, and we were stuck in traffic, actually, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George can sometimes be kind of a curmudgeon, and he was not in a very good mood. And he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we're going to be there again someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And, I mean, it doesn't matter what the resource is, if there's a finite amount of it and you're using it up, eventually it's gone. And so, I don't know, it might be a good idea to figure out. It's like, okay, let's talk about, I don't know, let's take a random example, oil. You know, it might not be a bad idea if you have your entire economy based on oil to ask what's going to happen when you run out. Okay, but I'm going to take it a step further. And this is true, it doesn't matter what your resource is, whether it's oil, copper, iron, you know, if it's a finite resource, eventually you run out. But I would take it a step further, and I would say that any way of living that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. If every year there are fewer salmon return than the year before, eventually there will be none. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons return than the year before, eventually there will be none. But in the meantime, they'll be really cheap in cities. And then I would actually take it a step further, and I would say, I mean, both of those are pretty obvious. We don't need to talk about those more, do we? I presume there aren't any, like, members of the Forest Service here, in which case we might have to go through it again. I would say that any way of living that's based on the use of resources won't last, because resources don't actually exist. Trees don't consider themselves timber resources, and salmon don't consider themselves fisheries resources. And this is a really important point for a couple reasons. One is that there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. Before anybody can destroy the world, you first have to destroy it inside. You have to destroy it internally, and then you can destroy it in the real physical world. Artie Lang has this great book called The Politics of Experience, in which he talks about the fundamental part of this is, this is sort of Cliff Notes version, is that if you can understand someone's experience, you can understand their behavior. How someone experiences the world affects their behavior. And if you perceive the world, if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees, I'm going to treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for fish. If when I look at fish, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at fish, I see fish, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, I'll treat it differently still. The same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. And if when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. That doesn't mean that, well, okay, let's step away from the women thing for a second and talk about trees and fish. That doesn't mean that I can't eat them. I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington a few years ago, and the interviewer said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what was the difference? He said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And I knew that that answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And so then later that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree answered right away, and what it said was, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. If I consume I had a big argument with this guy several years ago because he said that because I use toilet paper that I'm just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Plum Creek. And I told him that I thought that was kind of nonsense. And we said, go ask a tree. And I did go ask a tree, and the tree said, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then it also said, yeah, you are culpable, but not because you use toilet paper. You're culpable for a far worse reason, because you consume the flesh of trees, but you don't take responsibility for the continuation of their community by stopping Plum Creek. And everybody understands this deal. You know, bears know it, mergansers know it. Mergansers know that if you eat every newt in a pond, there's not going to be any newts left for you. You have to take responsibility. By responsibility, I don't mean stewardship. I don't mean any sort of dominion thing. What I mean, responsibility comes from a root that means to give in return. It means to respond to once again, to give in return. And, you know, our discourse is so stupid. You know, we were taught all the time that, you know, natural selection consists of survival of the fittest, survival of the meanest, survival of the most exploitative. And, you know, this shows how stupid our discourse is. I can disprove that in one sentence if you give me a couple of semicolons. And that is, those creatures who have survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually making your surroundings better, by improving your habitat. Duh. So that's all nice, Derek, but what does this have to do with civilization? And I've been bashing civilization for probably, gosh, close on 15 years now, and I thought with this book I probably better finally define it. And civilization I define as a way of living characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? A city I define as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. So what this means is that the Talawa, on whose land I now live, were not civilized. They didn't live in cities. They lived in villages, camps. They didn't require the importation of resources. They ate salmon, clams, huckleberries, deer, elk, salal, salmon. And then usually through the winter they would eat a lot of salmon. And they didn't require the importation of resources. They weren't civilized. So two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you require the importation of resources, I know it's a nasty word, but let's go ahead and use it. If you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. It can never be sustainable. Which means we could all become the best little green capitalists in the world. Doesn't fucking matter. Okay. The next thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for this particular resource, if you require it, you're going to take it. Which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to be huge, because how else are they going to get access to the oil that they need to run the economy? Okay, so that's the first premise. Yeah, so that's the first premise right here, these two lines. So you brought sleeping bags, right? I think we only have like 18 premises. Second premise is that traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. We've seen that once or twice. The third premise. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. I was doing a talk in Eugene a couple years ago, and in the Q&A, this one guy raised his hand, and he said, you know, I'm a nonviolent person. I don't commit any acts of violence, and I disagree that this is culture is based on violence, and I don't see any of it in my life. And it's important to the story, of course, it's a man. The first thing I said to him is, okay, great, so where's your shirt made? And he looked, and his shirt's made in Bangladesh. And I said, we don't even need to talk about this, do we? He's like, no. I said, okay, next, I'm just curious, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I don't own. I said, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he's like, well, I guess I get evicted. I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. And I said, okay, stop right there. What happens when the sheriff comes to your house? He knocks on the door, and you say, hey, I was just making dinner. Come on in. So he comes on in, and you cook him dinner. And then he sits down at the table, and you feed him dinner. And you don't poison him. And and then after dinner, you say, you know, it's really nice that you came over for a little while, but I don't really like your company all that much, so, and this is my home, so I think you should leave now. He said, well, I guess he'd take out a gun, and he would say, I'm here to evict you. Get out of your house. And I said, ah, so the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun's going to come and kick you out of your home. He said, I think I get it. Okay, let's try again. What happens if you're really hungry and you go to the grocery store and you start eating? You know, there's a lot of food there. And I said, what's going to happen to you? He said, well, I'm going to call the sheriff. He's going to come. Yeah, the guy's a real asshole, isn't he? the sheriff's going to come and take you away. So I said, okay, so the point is that you have to pay someone in order to have a place to live, and you have to pay someone to eat, to survive. And if you don't pay people for these things, corporations more likely, then somebody with a gun is going to come and do something bad to you. So one of the reasons that a lot of us can pretend that there isn't this violence in our lives is because, oh, it's like I was giving a talk in Massachusetts a couple years ago, and this one guy said, you know, we're living a lot more sustainably now than we were 100 years ago. And I said, what? And he said, look around. There are a lot more forests in Massachusetts now than there were 100 years ago. And I said, yeah, that's because you get your wood from South America. And so part of the problem is that we don't see a lot of the violence because it's exported. And it's exported, of course, onto members of the natural world. And then another reason that we don't see a lot of the violence is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we go along. And if you step out of line even a little bit, the full force of the state will come down on you. And I mean, I think that the Green Scare certainly teaches us that, among many other things. And okay, I think that's enough on that one. And we'll go on to the fourth premise now, which is that this culture, and this is, I think, my favorite premise, this culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible, unnoticed. When it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does occur, it's regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And there's so many examples of this. One example is that my father, when I was a child, my father was extremely violent. And my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head, and he broke my sister's arm, and he raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time, because not only had he fought back, but he had committed blasphemy by sending violence the wrong direction. That's one example, is that violence can only flow like that. Another example is, there's tons of bears where I live, and it's the cutest thing in the world. There's this one baby bear that's been coming around my mom's house. A mother and baby have been coming around. So like the baby, discovered steps at my mom's house. It's like running up the steps, running down the steps, running up the steps, down the steps. And then, he discovered glass too, because, the cat was sitting just inside the door, the glass door, and he ran over to make her run away. And, so he runs up to her and bonks his head right in the glass. And then of course he gets terrified and runs up a tree. And the cat the whole time is just sitting there looking at him. Anyway, so there's tons of bears around where I live, and I often walk in the forest at night without, a lantern or anything, and then everybody's like, oh my God, aren't you afraid of bears? Aren't you afraid they're gonna like kill you or something? And I know that there's one person dies in North America every other year because of bear attacks. And I mean, on the other hand, there's about 46,000 Americans die every year in automobile accidents. So the truth is, instead of me being worried when I walk through the forest, like you walk through a parking lot, it's like, oh my God, so the cars are all, or it's like, oh my God, here's a great example is that I live 3 miles from the ocean and I never get in. And you know why? Because that fucking movie Jaws, I saw that at the same time as Star Wars, and it, and the acting was so good there too. And I still don't get in the fucking water because of that movie. Sharks, I know there was this movie a couple years ago called Spring Break Shark Attack. It's like, God, I wish there was that many sharks still left in the world. Sharks are so damn dangerous, but the ratio of shark attacks on humans to, the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is about 20 million to one. But when the violence goes down the hierarchy, it's unnoticed. When it goes up, then it's like, oh my God, somebody got attacked by a shark. Another example. Cops. So I don't know if you know this, but every day in the United States, between 4 and 6 Americans die because they encounter police. Between 4 and 6. And that's through beatings, shootings, high-speed chases, and medical neglect in jails and prisons. And on the other hand, every time a cop dies, it's this big state funeral. The bumper stickers, all gave some gave all. And, all the cops are going down the road. And it's like, but you know what's the most dangerous civil service profession? Garbage collection. But when was the last time you saw a big state funeral for garbage? And the reason is because they're hanging around these big trucks who want to kill them. The trucks are like, we got you. And, but you never see a big state funeral for a garbage collector. You never see a bumper sticker that says some gave all, gave some. Or when was the last time you saw a Tom Cruise movie where this intrepid garbage man is cleaning up the mean streets of LA, It's like, doesn't happen because it doesn't valorize that violence. Okay, I want to try one more thing about this, which is, if you don't believe me about the cops, I have a little thought experiment to do here, which is the next time there's one of those WTO meeting or WTO protests or one of the, anti-war protests or something, all the cops are there in their full riot gear, take a baseball bat. Walk up to a cop and say, excuse me, officer friendly, I'm just doing an experiment, nothing personal, and then hit him. And then hit him a couple more times real fast. And then I'll talk to you in about 80 years. I have another one. Does anybody mind if I swear? So, yes? No? Well, make up your mind. Okay, so I would like, I want to talk about the word fuck, because it's the most amazing word in the English language, because it's all of patriarchy condensed to 4 letters. Because the same word that means make love to means do great violence to. And that's really, really messed up. Once again, that's everything you need to know about patriarchy. It's also really confusing because then somebody can say to me, I'm going to fuck you. And it's like, I need more information. fuck is really interesting because not only is it all a patriarchy condensed, but it's also, I mean, it gets really, really interesting because if sex and violence get conflated like that, which is, you know, just twisted right there, and then you have violence can only flow down the hierarchy within this culture, that suddenly helped me understand homophobia, which I had never understood at all before that. I mean, the whole thing on homophobia is like, if you don't like homosexuals, you probably shouldn't date one. But the way I really started to understand this was with the whole Clinton don't ask, don't tell thing, where like, you can be in the military, but you can be a homosexual in the military, but you can't talk about it, which I guess means you could still do it, but I need to say full disclosure before I go any further that I actually agree. I just have to say I agree that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military. I feel this very strongly, actually. But that probably doesn't mean as much as it could, because I also think that heterosexuals, asexuals, transgendered, bisexuals should not be allowed in the military either. But I had this idea the other day. What if, I think this is a great idea, what if they each had their own army? You know, it's like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. I don't know, maybe it might be kind of fun. Anyway, this spokesman, I finally understood homophobia. I never understood it at all. I finally understood it when this one spokesman, man, for the military was saying that the reason you can't have homosexuals in the military, he said, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? And I was thinking, yeah, sure, I can imagine that, but that wasn't really his point. And then he said it would destroy chain of command. I mean, the problem is not, and it wouldn't destroy chain of command because the lieutenant would fall so deeply in love with the private that he couldn't order him to his death. It would destroy chain of command because the fucking was going up the hierarchy. Notice he didn't say that if a lieutenant had sex with a private, because, oh, no, I need to go a different direction here for a second, which is that there's a great line by Catherine MacKinnon: man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. I love that. It's so great. And the objectification of women is so deep within this culture that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's almost impossible for the man not to objectify the woman. So a man and a woman are making love, and the man says to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. You know what just happened? She's the object of the sentence. Okay, so now a man and a woman are making love, and the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside me. She's still the object of the sentence. Can't get around it. Well, you can, actually. The man could say to the woman, I would like for you to be around me. And the woman's like, can we speak English? So anyway, the reason I finally understood this is because when you... how's this work? When you conflate sex and violence, when violence can only flow downhill, that means that you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the hierarchy than the fucker. And if the fuckee and the fucker are on the same level, then all the little tiny brains seize up. I think I've probably beaten that one to death enough. Okay, so wait. If I beat an idea to death, that's like the violence is... Okay, fifth premise of the book. The property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control, in everyday language to make money, by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Sixth premise of the book. Civilization is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. I mean, if somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, whatever that means, if someone would have brought it down 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, then people in this area after the collapse could still eat passenger pigeons, even ignoring their own beautiful existence for their own sake. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, people along the Columbia would still be able to eat salmon. I mean, just in terms of calories. I mean, there's going to be people sitting along the banks of the Columbia River 40 years from now. Well, they'd be glowing, for one thing, because of Hanford. But they'll be starving to death, and they'll be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't remove the dams on the Columbia River that were used to manufacture electricity to smelt bauxite into aluminum for beer cans. God damn you. If somebody would have brought it down 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry. We wouldn't have to worry about dioxin in every mother's breast. We wouldn't have to worry about pesticides. If somebody would have brought it down 60 years ago, we wouldn't really have to worry very much about global warming. I mean, what, are people in 40 years from now, they're going to be saying, God, if somebody would have brought it down 40 years ago, we'd still have amphibians? Are they going to say, if somebody brought it down 40 years ago, we'd still have, you know, polar bears, we'd still have great apes, we'd still have, you know, name it. Oh, I just want to mention, too, that there are 2 million dams in the United States. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall and 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. And people always say, God, Derek, you're so non-compromising. But, well, first off, I'll say that if we only took out one of those dams a day, the 7.5 feet tall ones or 6.5 feet tall ones, it would still take us 200 years to take them all out at one a day. And people always say, God, Derek, you don't want to compromise. But it's like, yeah, I'll compromise. Let's only take out 5 a day. It'll only take us 40 years. You know, the salmon don't have that long. The sturgeon don't have that long. Anyway, the eighth premise of the book. You know, another thing I was thinking, and this just occurred to me like 2 weeks ago. I mean, I've known this number about the dams for a long time. This just occurred to me about 2 weeks ago. That means, since all those dams have been made certainly in the last 200 years, that means that basically they were constructing a dam a day over 6.5 feet tall. That's really obsessive. This brings us to the eighth premise of the book. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I have just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the eighth premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least disallowing it from damaging your land base. Okay, ninth premise. And ninth premise is actually pretty interesting because I found that there are a lot of things that I can bash and everybody's fine with it. You know, I can bash capitalism. It was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can bash Christianity. It was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I can bash environmentalism. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can bash, you know, anti-civ people. That's all fine. I can bash, you know, I can bash corporations. Certainly, that's a great pastime. But there are a few things that if you start to bash them, then people really start to freak out. One of them, interestingly enough, I found that if I start to bash science, I can just feel the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. And another one is if I bash American Buddhism, it's all the pacifists start chasing me down the street. And another one, interestingly enough, is if you talk about population, sometimes people get really, really upset, and they accuse you of being anti-human for saying that someday the population will be much lower than it is now. And simply stating that observation means that you must hate people. And there's, yeah, I'll get to that in a second. There's the ninth premise is that although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of these ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would certainly reduce both population and consumption, yet would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Oh, and I need to define some terms here first, which is that, we'll talk about that in a second. Other ways would be characterized by much less violence. And I need to say, you know, I say that I don't believe there's going to be a voluntary transformation, but every cell in my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation. And it's the same with population. You know, every cell in my body wants for us to approach, and I'm going to talk about population more in a second, but every cell in my body wants for us to approach the whole question of there being more humans than the planet can support sort of reasonably and intelligently and to just address the issue head on. I mean, if I ran for president, you know, my campaign would be based around, you know, vasectomies for everyone, for every male. In fact, when I was up in Canada recently, at a talk I did in Guelph, somebody shouted out, "What would be your campaign slogan?" And I didn't know, so I asked them to come up with one for me, and they came up with a great one, which is a snip in every sack. So I'm ready to run. We'll talk about this in a second. So the point is that personally and collectively, we may be able to both reduce the amount and soften the character of violence that occurs during this ongoing and perhaps long-term shift, or we may not. But this much is certain. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will almost undoubtedly be far more severe and the privation more extreme. And if we don't talk about this mess we're in. So having said all that, I need to say, by the way, that I don't think that population is a primary problem. I think that population is actually a tertiary problem. The reason it's secondary instead of primary is that, I need to back up and define terms here, that humans have exceeded carrying capacity. That's pretty fundamental, I think. And what carrying capacity is the capacity of any place to support a specific number of whatever species you're talking about forever. So you can have an island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer, could support 1,000 deer forever. And if 1,000 deer, if you exceed that carrying capacity, you can permanently reduce the carrying capacity. You overshoot it and then you crash. So if you put 10,000 deer on that island that can support 1,000, they will eat too much of the vegetation, they'll denude the landscape, and the population will crash. And, you know, they always say that there is no such thing as a stupid question, but I actually got one recently. And I was doing a radio program in Humboldt County, one county south of where I live, and there's this guy that whenever I'm on this program, he hates my work so much that he calls in, and I think he attacks me. I never can figure out what he's saying, though. And this time he called up, he was just sputtering, and he said, "How dare you say that humans have conceded their capacity to care?" It's like, well, that may be the case, but that's an entirely different question. But the reason I don't think that, yes, there are more humans than the planet can support, but the reason that I don't think that population is primary is because numbers actually don't matter. If you had 100 gazillion people on the planet, it wouldn't matter if they didn't eat, shit, or stand anywhere. The important thing is how much damage you cause. And the reason this is really important is because when I think about overpopulation, the first thing I think of is a little brown baby in a third world nation. And when I think of overconsumption, the first thing I think of is an American. And who's causing more problems? But the reason that population isn't even secondary, but it's a tertiary problem, are there any demographers here? Any demographers? Good, I hate demographers. And the reason I hate demographers is because they often talk about something called a natural rate of population increase. And What that is, you know, if you have X number of humans and then, you know, time goes on, you know, it'll just exponentially grow. And it presumes that people breed like rabbits. But the truth is, I don't even think the rabbits breed like rabbits. I think that people make rational family planning decisions based on their personal and social circumstances. And if you have, for example, a culture that has, that somebody writes a book, and in this book they tell people to go forth and multiply, and this book is a really big bestseller, then that may influence people's reproductive choices. And likewise, if you have a culture that systematically does not see violence against the natural world as violence, that may affect their reproductive choices. On the other hand, the Talawa, on whose land I live, they lived there prior to contact for at least 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of the Talawa, then they lived there since the beginning of time. In either case, it's a really long time. Oh, and I have to tell you about this thing that happened. Okay, Christina's here. Is there anybody else who was at that talk I did in Princeton? Is there anybody else here who was there that night? Remember that guy in the audience this one guy said, you know, okay, so what, they were there for 12,500 years. That doesn't mean that they were living sustainably. She'll verify. I'm not lying. So I said, okay, give me a threshold. Would 20,000 years be enough? 30? 40? 60? 100? How about a million? A million years. A million years. Remember that? A million years would not be enough for him. Because he said we'd have to have quantitative data showing fuck knows what. That's neither here nor there. So if you have a culture that is in an intimate reciprocal relationship with their land base, when they start to have too many babies, they might throttle back on the babies. I probably shouldn't use throttle and babies in the same. I read somewhere that Native North Americans used about 350 different plants and herbs for contraceptives and abortifacts. And God, I mean, it was the women who made the decision to use them too. I said, what a bunch of fucking primitives. I gotta tell the story. I love this story. Back at one point, anthropology was exclusively male, and they would go out and they would talk to indigenous people and say, how do you not have babies? And of course they talked to the men because they're the ones we're talking to, and they'd say, how is it that you can have sex and not have babies? And the men are like, well, you sing. And so the anthropologists were writing, you know, indigenous peoples don't know how babies are made, and or not made, as the case may be. And then later, when there were women who would join the field of anthropology, they would go and they would talk to the women of the female indigenous peoples, and they would say, you know, how do you not get pregnant? And then we're like, oh, you eat this certain root when you're 16, and then you're sterile for 5 years, and blah blah blah. And the men are like, really? So the point is that the problem isn't even secondary, because the problem isn't consumption itself. The problem is the mindset that leads to this overconsumption and the culture that leads to the overconsumption. Okay, now having said all that, you know, back to this idea of someday there will be far fewer humans than there are at present. There was this one woman, I did two talks one day in Eugene, Oregon, and this one woman hated what I had to say so much that she came to both of the talks. And at the talk, she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And she also said, you were such a nice boy until you opened your mouth. I hit the trifecta that day. And I guess this was pre-George Bush, so if there would have been George Bush, she probably would have added him too. The reason is because I want to bring down civilization, and bringing down civilization will kill a lot of people. Therefore, I'm a mass murderer. And I have actually a bunch of responses to this. because actually I think it is a really, really, really important question. I didn't like how she phrased it, but it's an important question. And my first answer is that bringing down civilization, well, here's how I define bringing down civilization, as depriving the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and depriving the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. That's a nice piece of philosophy, Derek, but the truth is bringing down civilization is going to kill a lot of people. Okay, my next answer is if you participate in this economic system, your hands are blood red already because the system is based on systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet. That's really nice, Derek, but if you bring down civilization, it's going to kill a lot of people. Okay, my next answer is that bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. It's a billion different acts done by a billion different people. And if you include non-human people, it's, you know, a gazillion different people. And all of those different acts are going to have different moralities. And that doesn't mean that they won't cumulatively have some collective morality, because of course they will. But also we need to differentiate. For example, I don't care what your motivation is, it would be an atrocity to blow up a children's hospital. I don't care if you're an anarcho-primitivist or if you're a member of the U.S. military. You cannot construct a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. Oh, yeah, you can, actually. If you're bringing freedom and democracy to the country, then. Which, by the way, I figured out how to listen to George Bush's speeches without going insane. Well, one is to turn the volume down. Another way, and this has to do with, remember the whole freedom fries thing? That's what gave me the clue. It's kind of like one of those jiu-jitsu things. You know, I took what they did and turned it back around. And you just do word substitutions. And it's really fun. So every time he says the word freedom, substitute the word fascism. And every time he says the word democracy, substitute corporate control. It's a one-to-one correspondence. It's beautiful. So we are bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. It's like, yeah, you are actually. It's fun for the whole family. Just try it. I want to say something about the we thing too. And it's like, we are bringing freedom. And it's like, I was at the post office a couple days ago, and the guy at the post office said, how much longer do you think before we bomb Iran? And I didn't get into it with him because he's at the post office. And anyway, but there's this friend of mine called me up a few months ago, and she said, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, we're in Iraq? I thought we're in Northern California. She says, Derek, okay, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq? And I said, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to blow up the Grand Coulee Dam, will they do it? And she's like, Derek, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. But I think that's a really important thing, because if we identify with them, we're not killing the planet. If we identify... We'll talk more about that later. Okay, so anyway, you know, it doesn't matter what your motivation is. If you blow up a children's hospital, that's an atrocity. On the other hand, I think it would be almost impossible to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. I mean, you just can't do it. I mean, the cell phone towers are so nasty. I mean, they allow the jerk at the next table to yammer on when you're trying to eat. And then cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. And then also they put out those electromagnetic waves, and then they make it so like you have to wear the aluminum beanie, and I always forget like which side goes on the out. It's a problem. Anyway, but it's okay. I can make a moral case against taking out a cell phone tower. Here we go. There's this woman who's driving along late at night, and her car dies. Oh, check out the language. Her car dies. The car doesn't die. The car's not alive. It's like, wait until I get the parking lot, and the car's all going, we're going to get you for that one, buddy. The car conks out, and she pulls over the side of the road, and she calls a cop, and she dials 911, and she says, my car conked out by the side of the road, and can you come start it for me, please? And the cop says yes. This is a fantasy. Let's go with it. And then so she's sitting there while she's waiting. She turns on the radio, and she hears that this homicidal maniac with a hook on his arm has escaped from the homicidal maniac place. I think it's called the White House. And anyway, so he's escaped from there, and he likes to prey on women whose cars have conked out by the side of the road. And so she's, you know, all nervous, and then the cop shows up, and he knocks on the window, and she makes him show both hands. And then he starts the car for her, and she pulls away. As she pulls away, there's this tug on the car. And when she gets home, she looks on the passenger side, and there's this bloody hook embedded in the passenger side door. Did other people's older siblings terrorize you with that story when you were a kid, too? Anyway, so a cell phone saved her life. You know, we cannot, it would be immoral to take out, but we can just as easily make a moral case in favor of taking out cell phone towers, because the woman's driving along late at night, and she's on this deserted country road, and she calls her mother, and she never calls her mother, and doesn't call her very often, and her mother rushes to the phone, and she picks up the phone, and right as she picks up the phone, she trips, and she breaks her neck. And as she's lying there, she gasps, "Call 911, I broke my neck. And why don't you ever call me?" And then her daughter dials 911, and thank God she has two cell phones. And anyway, so she dials 911, and now she's driving without using her hands, and the car veers off the road, and it runs over three orphans, and then goes over the last population of an endangered salamander, and she smashes into a tree. And then the last thing she sees before she passes out is this hook gleaming in the moonlight. And the point, insofar as there is one, is that we can make up any sort of hypothetical situation that'll make it so we don't do anything at all. Okay, but that's fine, Derek, but taking down civilization will kill a lot of people. Okay, my next response is, which people are we talking about? Are we talking about marlin people? Are we talking about swordfish people? Are we talking about salmon people? Are we talking about prairie dog people? I think if you ask salmon if people should bring down civilization, they'd be like, do it. Ask polar bears, they're like, yep. Ask prairie dogs, and they're like, yep. But you know what? We don't care about those anyway. What about human people? They're the ones we care about. Well, I think that the rural poor around the world would be better off immediately. I asked the former executive director of Food First, Anuradha Mittal, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and just said, yes, of course. And a couple examples she gave were that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. The 50,000 villagers in Turkey who are going to be displaced by a dam that was stopped and now has started again would be better off if the global economy disappeared. All the subsistence farmers would be better off. Traditional indigenous people would be better off. Years ago, I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, and I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And he said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's it right there. That's the entire struggle. You know, thank you very much. Good night. That's it. And they would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. Okay, and the rural rich would be better off. Well, they wouldn't be better off. Okay, the rural rich wouldn't be better off, but they'd be okay. They got guns. They'll be fine. The urban poor would be, well, in the long run, the urban poor, and this is not a joke, but in the long run, the urban poor would be better off because the system that's exploiting them would be gone. In the short run, they would be dead. In the short run, the urban poor would be worse off than they are right now. And that's because this system, like any good abusive system, has made us dependent upon the very system that's exploiting us. Any good abuser does that. Because if you don't, those you're exploiting are going to leave. And that's what I think on one hand, but on another hand, I think that might not be the case for the urban poor, because you want to talk about instant land reform? Remove the support from, I mean, if you stopped the flow of weapons and money from the United States to third world elites, there'd be instant land reform. So maybe not. I don't know. Which leaves us only with the urban rich. And would they be better off? No, but fuck them. They're the problem in the first place. That's very nice, Derek. But the fact remains that taking down civilization will kill a lot of people. And I finally came up with an answer. After all those, I finally came up with an answer that I'm really happy with. And that's this, which is, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about David Ortiz this year? We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. God, the fucking socks just collapsed, didn't they? Anyway, we probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who'll be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that, although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that. Likewise, those people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. I have a new catchphrase: dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas, that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. 10th premise of the book. The culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. The culture is driven by a death urge, an urge to destroy life. I don't need to talk about everybody being insane, do I? Go on. Oh, but I don't know if this happens to you. Sometimes the vision of Angelina Jolie will rise up and appear before me. It makes me happy. It used to scare me back when she was with Billy Bob. They were bad for each other. Each one had a vial of the other's blood around their neck. And do you know where she had his name tattooed? Oh my God, I'll bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it must be true. Does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? So Northern New England was Wabanaki?
Yeah, and that, like, the Abenaki Alliance, so the Abenaki people, it's the same consumer.
But does anybody know what's, thank you, and does anybody know what's the name for this place? I think it's insane that I can tell you that, oh gosh, that the Red Sox have collapsed. Or, I'm sorry?
Africa?
This place right here? The name of this place is Africa? What, okay, whose land is this?
Penobscot.
And what I'm asking is, what is their name for this place? Okay, so what I think is insane is that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, which I can guarantee will never affect my own personal life. And I don't know the names. Oh, first off, and it took me 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. And then if you go over here to a place called Achalet, there was another massacre about a mile away. And then about a mile over here, there was a massacre at a place called Ahuanket. And it took me a couple years to learn that. And it's insane that I can tell you statistics of various baseball players, that the Seattle Mariners picked up Ben Broussard in midseason, which I think was actually quite a good deal. Talk about a collapse. Man, the Mariners just nosedived. And they were already terrible. It's insane that I can tell you about that, but that I can't tell you 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of my home. That's crazy, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. I mean, okay, let's try. Huckleberry, blackberry, salal, thimbleberry, salmonberry. I'm doing okay. Chanterelle, huckleberry. Oh, and then those big red mushrooms with the white dots. You know, I was thinking, if I eat one of those, I can take out a dam all by myself. I can take out a dam with one finger. One of the reasons that we don't defend the places that we'd live is that we don't live there. We live with Brad and Angelina and with Tom and Katie and Suri and with Pedro and with David. We don't live where we live. Anyway, the 11th premise of the book. Okay, what I'd like to do is I want to talk about the 11th premise. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do in a second. I'll just do it. How's that? The 11th premise of the book. And this might be the most important one. that from the beginning, this culture, civilization, has been a culture of occupation, and the government has been a government of occupation. What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it extracts, it facilitates the extraction of resources and facilitates the maximization of production, and doesn't really care about communities. What does the U.S. government do? Moves in, facilitates the extraction of resources, blah, blah, blah. I want to read something about that. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Oh, we'd watch television, by gum. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? Can you imagine people used to actually drink from rivers? How quaint is that? What if they did this because, hell, I can't finish that sentence, because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms and the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them their marching orders? And what would we all do if instead of it being, you know, the government to which we pledged allegiance, what would we do if it were space aliens who would come down from, that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically vacuum the oceans, started to systematically just deforest the planet, you know, and they put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, and they were changing the actual climate, and they were melting the ice caps, and they took 90% of the large fish in the oceans. What would we do if they were space aliens who were doing this? I mean, I know exactly what we would do. We would put on our camo outfits. We would grab our AK-47s. We would have... Wrong audience. So, like, am I the only person here with an AK-47? You know, I shared the stage with Ward Churchill a while back, and he was in the audience when I was talking, and I asked the same question. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? Just silence from the audience, and then I hear this voice go, nope. Or what would we do if instead of it being, you know, space aliens or something, what if it was the Iraqis who had come in? You know, the Iraqis were so close to invading. They were, like, this close. If the Iraqis had invaded and they were putting up 2 million dams in the United States, what would we do? We would know what to do. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dozens of carcinogens into the flesh of your lover? Children, mother, brother, sister, father. How many people here have had someone you love die of cancer? It's about 80%. Cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not so secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues? Or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can or won't give the threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. What I'd like to do now is very quickly talk about, just read one, two more premises, then talk about one premise, and then read two things, and then bash hope, and then read two things. That's what I'm going to do. Okay. Premise number 12. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. They're just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor often denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of paper. Those without the papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. So, you know, people say that Weyerhaeuser or Plum Creek own a lot of land. They don't. They have in their possession pieces of paper that we all agree mean that they own land. We all just agree that's a shared, we all share that same assumption. I mean, it's like there's a bunch of cars out there in the parking lot. They don't actually belong to anyone. And I can say this because, of course, my truck is on the other side of the continent. But there's just cars, and then we all agree that this car belongs to you, this car belongs to you. And I want to be really clear. When I say that Plum Creek doesn't actually own any land, I'm, A, not saying that that shared delusion doesn't have effects in the real world, because, of course, it does. I'm also not saying that there is no such thing as ownership. The land where I live belongs to the Talua. And the reason it belongs to the Talua is because they lived there for 12,500 years, and their blood is mixed with the soil forever. And they have participated in that predator-prey reciprocal relationship for so long that they own the land and the land owns them. I also want to be clear that I'm not saying that we need to throw out every cultural convention. What I'm saying is that with the world at stake, it might not be a bad idea to start examining the cultural conventions we have and decide which ones we want to honor and which ones we don't want to honor. 13th premise of the book. Those in power rule by force, and the sooner we break ourselves of illusions to the contrary, the sooner we can at least begin to make reasonable decisions about whether, when, or how we're going to resist. Skip the next premise. We'll go to the 15th premise very quickly. This is another one of my favorite ones. Love does not imply pacifism. I love this one. I get this all the time. It's like, Derek, you know, if you loved enough, you just need to love the CEOs. If you love the CEOs enough, then, well, something good will happen. And you're just hurting yourself by being angry at them, by hating them. And if you really loved enough, you could never even consider doing any act of violence to anyone. I don't think that love implies pacifism, and I think Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. I grew up in the country, and I have in my life been attacked by mother horses, cows, chickens, mice, geese, hummingbirds, hawks, eagles, spiders, dogs, cats, who thought I was attacking their babies. If a mother mouse will attack someone 6,000 times her size, what the hell's wrong with us? One of the reasons I wrote this book is because when I would do talks about fighting back, the response by the audience was really predictable, and they fell into separate camps. Like, a lot of sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists, a lot of them and a lot of sort of mainstream environmentalists would put up what I've taken to calling Gandhi shields. And that means they would say Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, Gandhi again and again as quickly as they could to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then grassroots environmentalists would do the same thing, but they would come up to me after the talk and they would say, thank you for bringing this up. And then the other group I found the most interesting, which was like family farmers, survivors of domestic violence, a lot of the very poor, a lot of people of color, prisoners, a lot of American Indians, a lot of radical environmentalists would look at me like, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro. And I thought about that distinction for a long time, and I finally realized that the difference is, for all those latter groups, violence isn't some capital V thing. When you've experienced it in your own body, not always, but oftentimes, it simply becomes a part of life. It doesn't mean you participate in it. It means it's just part of life, and you deal with it. It's not capital V. You don't reify it. You don't deify it. You don't make it into something it's not. It's a big deal, and it's a very small deal. It's part of life. Every bear knows that. Every frog knows it. Every giant water bug knows it. Anybody who's ever been pinched by a giant water bug knows it. And then, oh, I gotta say this. I just have to do this. Sorry. Sorry I'm going on so long, but I just have to do this. So part of the reason I wrote this book, it was originally gonna be, it's two books. Part of the reason, it was originally gonna be this like 100-page pamphlet that was gonna be, I was gonna take a lot of the sort of standard arguments that are thrown out by pacifists, because a lot of times when I would do this, then the pacifists would just get so pissed off, and they would all throw out the same arguments all the time that I'm sure every one of us have heard, and we could all like do the little sing along with the bouncing ball thing if we had them written down. And I just wanted to sort of deal with those all at once with this pamphlet. So next time I ask the same goddamn thing about you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house, I could just hear, look at the pamphlet. So I just want to take care of a couple of those right now. One of them is you can't use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. First off, anybody who ever says that has never read the essay from which it came, because the essay had nothing to do with pacifism. It had to do with the inclusion of a wide variety of voices. And but what's actually more important, and I mean, I love Audre Lorde, she's great, but I'll tell you this, she never worked construction, because it's a terrible metaphor, because it doesn't matter whose fucking tools you use. You can use the master's tools as man of the master's house, you can use my tools, you can use your tools, you can use anybody's tools. And there's a deeper problem too, which is that this presumes that violence is one of the master's tools, that those in power own violence. And look, those in power have tried to convince us they own the land. They tried to convince us they own the water. They tried to convince us they own the trees, because how could the Forest Service put out timber sales if they didn't own the trees? They've tried to convince us they own genetic material. And I'll be goddamned if I'm going to let them say they own violence too. They don't own it. And once again, I think Mother Grizzly Bear is going to back me up on this one. Those in power do not own violence. It's not one of their tools. Sure, they use it, but they also use discourse. Does that mean we can't use discourse? They own the means of industrial religion production. Does that mean that we can't use spirituality? They own the means of industrial education. Does that mean we can't use education? Can we not use anything they use? We may as well just give up. The next one, there's another one is, I love this one too. They say, you know, you're so dualistic, Derek. You know, you talk about us and them, and when you talk about them, you're reinforcing that dualism, and you're reinforcing that there is a them and an us, and that's part of the problem. The whole dualisms need to be eradicated. And so whenever somebody says that to me, I always say, ah, so what you're saying is dualism bad, non-dualism good. Checkmate. Another one is, I guess the last one I'll do, and then I'll bash Hope for a minute, is another one. Oh, gosh, I can't remember the others, but there's another one that is really big, which is, oh, I know one. Oh, God, I'm going to do two. This one's so embarrassing. I can't even believe this. This is so, so embarrassing. I can't even say it. I mean, this is like admitting to be a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. Really? Okay, how many people here have a copy of A Language Older Than Words? Okay, how many people also have a straight razor? Okay, what I'd like for you to do when you get home is take the chapter Violence Revisited and take the razor and cut those pages out. Crumple them up and throw them away, because they're so embarrassing. Because in that chapter, I'd rather talk about compulsive masturbation. In that chapter, I actually said, if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. Okay. So, does this mean that the woman who kills the man who's attempting to rape her runs the risk of becoming a rapist? Does this mean that the tiger who kills a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? Does this mean that Tecumseh ran the risk of becoming like the people who are trying to steal his land? It just doesn't make any sense. And I can't believe I actually wrote that. And then the other one I want to do is that they say violence never accomplishes anything. And it's like, oh, that's just bullshit. That's fucking bullshit. It's goddamn fucking bullshit. It's George Bush goddamn fucking bullshit. So what that means is all the Africans jumped on the slave ships and they came over and they just worked in the cotton fields, in the rice fields, in the sugar fields for the hell of it. And that means all the American Indians said, hey, want some land? Here you go. There's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says that anywhere, any woman, anywhere in the world can be walking alone late at night. And if she hears footsteps on the road behind her, she has reason to be afraid. She calls that the democracy of fear. Don't fucking tell me that violence doesn't accomplish anything. It has radically changed the behavior of half of the population of the human species. Violence accomplishes a hell of a lot. Oh, wait a second. This culture is based on violence, and violence doesn't accomplish anything, which means the culture doesn't exist. We're done. Okay, so what I'd like to do now... Oh, shoot, I forgot about this earlier. Sorry, can I go on about one other thing for a minute and then talk about hope? When I was talking about the reasons why, you know, the responses to the woman who said that if you bring down civilization, that will kill a lot of people, the other response, which I think is the most important one, which I forgot earlier, which is that through the crash, I can guarantee that almost 100% of the horrors are going to come because those whose lifestyles are already killing the planet attempt to maintain those lifestyles. They have the power to make it a softer landing, and they will choose to not do that. It's like if somebody blew the dams on the Colorado, or if they collapsed on their own, and the Colorado River once again reached the ocean, then I can guarantee if the capitalist press is still around, they will bray as one that people are thirsty. It's like right now, we hear all the time, the world's running out of water, the world's running out of water, people are dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. Bullshit. People are not dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. They're dying of thirst because the water is being stolen. 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. So if the dams were to collapse, I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there still existed a single irrigated alfalfa field in Arizona, a single citrus orchard, a single golf course. Human beings in cities, metropolitan human beings, use the same amount of water as are used by metropolitan golf courses. I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed a single golf course, a single swimming pool, so long as Las Vegas still existed. It's like one of the reasons they want to raise the Shasta Dam is because, as Senator Dianne Feinstein said, it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawns. You cannot argue with that. Except with explosives. Okay, so anyway, I want to bash hope for a couple minutes. And then read two very short things. A few years ago, a friend of mine called, and she was in tears. She's an environmental activist in Northern California, works on pesticide issues. She was just sobbing. And she said, you know, this work is so hard. So hard. It breaks my heart. It's killing me. I said, yeah, it'll do that. And she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. And she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I knew that was the best thing I could say is because about 13 or 14 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into sobs many times a week over the death of the salmon, the death of bull trout, the death of Selkirk caribou, Kootenai sturgeon. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, take some time off, Derek. The problem will still be there when you come back. And I knew that that wasn't what I needed to do. I knew that if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what do tears mean? You know, when are you going to cry if you're not going to cry about that? And I knew I just had to keep pushing. And then one day I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan Indian writer and activist. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. It's so hard. And she said, yeah, it'll break your heart. It'll do that. And I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is, unless it's stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could possibly say is because it normalized my despair. And it let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that sorrow is just sorrow and that pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or even the pain that hurts as it is my response, as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. You know, there's this idea that if you really acknowledge how bad things are, you have to run around being miserable all the time. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we are really, really fucked. And that life is really, really good. And that we're so fucked. And life is just so, so good. And we're really fucked. And life's really good. I got this email from somebody a while back in which she asked me how my anger at the dominant culture affected my sex life. And I was so tempted to write back, you know, that's a question to which you will never know the answer. I realized, though, that the question was based on the idea that anger's a shotgun. And that just because I'm angry at the dominant culture, that I'm angry at my friends. But the truth is, I'm angry at the things that make me angry, and I'm not angry at the things that don't make me angry. And I respect the things I respect, and I don't respect the things I don't respect. And I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart, I'm so full of rage, and I'm so full of hate, and I'm so full of love, and I'm so full of joy, and I'm so full of satisfaction and dissatisfaction and contentment and discontent. And we're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time. But I realized something even more powerful than that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me, which is that I could feel all those things and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. Not through threats, not through violence, not through promises. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The smartest thing the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? You want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way. Sigmund Bauman has this great line, rational people will go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. I would say rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world as long as you allow them to think that buying recycled light or buying low-energy light bulbs will save the day. Once again, at every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very, very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. No, listen. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that my mother stayed with my father is because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations and they blind us to real possibilities. What are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? Does anybody really think that if we just ask nicely that Plum Creek or Weyerhaeuser will stop deforesting? Does anybody think that if we just ask nicely that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing? Does anybody really think that if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay? Oh, I gotta tell you this. I did a talk a while back. Some Democrats brought me someplace to do a talk. And they had a dinner for me beforehand. And my mom came along because it was close to home. And at the dinner, I said, so what are you going to talk about tonight? I said, I'm going to talk about taking down civilization. And it was just silence. And then later on, one of them is saying, you know, if we can just take back the White House and if we can just take over both houses of Congress, then things will be okay. And I'm thinking, yeah, I wouldn't mind taking over both houses of Congress, but I don't think I mean the same thing you do. And that's a joke, Mr. Gonzalez. Put away the electrodes. Anyway, so you know, they're saying if we, the Democrats, can just take over the White House, things will be okay. And my mom says, you know, the Democrats are just as controlled by corporations as the Republicans. And it was so funny. It was just like my mom had just hiked up a cheek and farted. Because there's just silence for a second, and then noses wrinkle. And then somebody finally says, could you please pass the hummus? It's really delicious. Anyway, so what are the false hopes that tie us, you know? I mean, does anybody really think that shorter showers are going to save the day? You know, does anybody really think? Okay, what it will take for salmon to survive. Oh, here's another thing that's really important, is that one of the reasons that we don't win is because we don't want to win. We don't even know what does it mean to win. We don't know what we want. You know, one of the reasons that we keep losing is because the other side knows exactly what they want. They want every fucking tree, and they want it now. And what do we want? Do we want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? What do we want? I know what I want. I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less dioxin every year than the year before in every mother's breast milk. I want to live in a world that is not being destroyed. And I will do whatever it takes to get there. I will do whatever it takes to get there. There is only one measure by which we're going to be judged by the people who come after. They're not going to give a shit about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, or didn't vote at all, or voted for Ralph Nader, or voted for Emma Goldman. They're not going to give a shit. They're going to give a shit about whether they can drink the water, whether they can breathe the air, whether they can live on the land. They're not going to care about whether we recycle. They're not going to care about whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care about how hard we tried. What they're going to care about is whether the land will support them. I feel so embarrassed saying this. Everything comes from the land. Without the land, you have nothing. We can fantasize all we want about some groovy eco-socialist utopia with free love for everybody. It doesn't fucking matter if you can't breathe, if you can't drink the water. I have a new slogan, which is protect your land base. You can't have sex without it. Everything comes from the land. Anyway, so what are the false hopes that keep us tied to the system? And what I'm thinking is, it's like what it will take for salmon to survive are six things. What they need are six things. Dams to be removed, industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop, industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff, global warming to stop, which means the industrial economy to stop, and for the oceans not to be murdered. Those are all technically doable tasks. It only becomes difficult cognitively when we say, how can we save salmon without removing dams? Then it becomes cognitively really challenging because you can't do it. That's a false hope. to think that we can have salmon and dams, to think that we can have air conditioning and no global warming. They're tied. Everybody knows this. Okay, but it's not, the problems aren't just false hopes, but it's hope itself. Because I was doing a talk a couple years ago, and I was just bashing hope, and somebody in the audience shouted out, "What's hope? What is your definition of hope?" I was like, "Oh my God, you know, I've been bashing hope for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about." And so I asked them to define hope, and somebody in the audience came up with a great definition. Actually, the whole audience together came up with a great definition, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. And this is how we use it in everyday language. I don't say, "I hope that I eat something tomorrow. I'm just going to do it." Or, you know, "I know that men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit to you here in public that I'm going to eat tomorrow. I don't hope I eat tomorrow. I'm simply going to do it." On the other hand, when I get on an airplane tomorrow, I hope it doesn't crash. Because once I'm in the air, I have no agency. And then think about this with a little kid. Okay, a little kid says to the mother says, "Clean your room." The little kid says, "I hope it gets done." Non-starter. The mother says, "Yeah, I hope it gets done too." Anyway, so when I say, "I hope that coho salmon survive," what I'm saying is I have no agency. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure the dominant culture does not drive them extinct. If they don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they do not want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I will do whatever it takes. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. When speaking of the apocalypse, it is customary to end on a happy note. And so I'm going to read two very short sections and then we'll be done. The first one is, the first one I didn't write. The first one was written by a stream near my home. I was trying to write what it's like to be a river, and I tried for several days, and I realized that that's really stupid. Why should I try to write what it's like to be a river when I can simply go ask one? That'd be like me trying to write what it's like to be a woman when I can just ask you. And so I went down and I asked the stream, "What is it like to be you?" And I've since realized that that is the fundamental question in any relationship. What is it like to be you? Romantic relationships, relationship with trees, anybody. Romantic relationships with trees. What is it like to be you? And I don't think we ask that question often enough. You think I'm kidding about romantic relationships with trees. If only you knew. Anyway, I asked the stream, and the stream had been waiting a long time for someone to ask because it gave me the answer right away, 5 seconds literally. I ran inside, wrote it down as quickly as I could, didn't even edit it. And I got to tell you, the stream is a way better writer than I am. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You're the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You're the mist who settles on the soil. You're the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who's all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You're the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees and the meadows you flood and feed and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who, with their own bodies, again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You're the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You are the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. And finally, I want to talk about a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers. It's called the picket pin and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers will be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold. A specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one. We would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we will be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, so Derek, what do you want us to do with all this information, all this analysis? And I always say, don't listen to me. I don't know how to live sustainably. I don't know how to live here. What's the nearest river? What's the nearest river? St. George. If you want to know how to live sustainably, ask the St. George River. It knows how to live here. It's lived here for a very long time. If you want to know how to live sustainably, ask the mountains, ask the forests, ask the trees, ask the bay, ask the ocean. If you ask them, they will tell you what they need. And then really the only question is, once again, are you willing to do it? Thank you very much.